This morning we are continuing our exposition of Esther by looking at the fourth chapter, which turns out to be very crucial in the development of the plot. And I'd like to begin by reading for you a number of quotations from outside the Bible. Give me liberty or give me death. That, of course, was Patrick Henry. What hath God wrought? Those words are from the Bible, but they were spoken famously by Samuel Morse. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. Winston Churchill. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. Astronaut Neil Armstrong. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. Martin Luther King Jr. And one more. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. Ronald Reagan. Well, those well-known quotations represent what we would call defining moments in the history of our world. They are all brief and spoken in a matter of seconds, but they encapsulate whole streams of human experience and human struggle and human thought, and all of them had a dramatic impact on subsequent events. As we come to Esther chapter 4, that is the sort of thing that we're looking at. We are coming to the defining moment of this story. And you can capture it as well in two brief statements that identify clearly what the defining moment is. One of them is in verse 14, where Mordecai asks, who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? And when Esther finally agrees to plead with Xerxes on behalf of the Jews, in verse 16, she declares, if I perish, I perish. That response of hers, it marks a significant change in her characterization in this story. And eventually leads to a mighty victory of the Jewish people over their enemies. The defining moment. That's what's happening here in Esther chapter 4. Our own lives and our efforts to serve the Lord in our world might be summarized as well in a few short statements or a few pretty relatively brief moments that nevertheless become turning points in our lives and in our influence for the Lord. These moments may not be as dramatic. They may not be as epic. They may not be as far-reaching as what's going on in Esther chapter 4. But they still have a profound impact on the direction of our own lives and on the impact that we have in the lives of other people. What tends to happen in those defining moments is we recognize the weightiness of what's happening, as we consider perhaps the difficulty of making the right choice, what tends to happen is that we waver in uncertainty and in fear. And in fact, that fear, sometimes we let it overcome us and it prevents us from making the right choice. We never know when we're going to face another defining moment. For some of you, it could be this week. For some of us, it may not be for a while. But either way, we face the kinds of choices and the kinds of stresses that Esther did. And what we find in this passage is encouragement from the Lord to resist fear, to entrust ourselves to the sovereign God, and to step out in faith and do whatever it is he is calling us to do in our generation and in our situation. So we see going on in this chapter with Esther, and the chapter is more or less a back and forth conversation between Mordecai and Esther. They're not talking directly, they're talking through intermediaries, but there are these exchanges, this back and forth, this one person makes a statement, the other pushes back, and it gets a little tense between Mordecai and Esther. But as we listen to their conversation step by step, we're going to see the progression of thought and an underlying theological progression, really, the progression that finally leads this woman to stick her neck out and to do something courageous in order to seek the deliverance of her people from destruction. And so the interchanges begin in response to the first descriptive scene in verses 1 to 3. And what is going on here, I could put it in these terms, is that adversity creates distress. Adversity creates an overwhelmingly distressful circumstance for the people of God. We were introduced to the adversity, the persecution, at the end of chapter 3. We read there that the whole city of Susa was in confusion as a result of the king agreeing to Haman's proposal that on a certain day, about a year later, all this nation could be wiped out. And now the word gets out to the people of God, and they are overcome with emotional distress. Here's what verses 1 to 3 say. When Mordecai learned all that had been done, Mordecai tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city, and he cried out with a loud and bitter cry. He went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one was allowed to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. And in every province, wherever the king's command and his decree reached, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and lamenting, and many of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. Adversity creates distress. And you can tell by reading those words that the author is shouting at you the stress of God's people. Mordecai was shouting, and now the author is shouting as well by all this repetition of the grief and the struggle and the confusion of God's people. Whether it was Mordecai's own emotion in verses 1 to 2 or the very broad statement of verse 3 that in every province, wherever the king's command and decree reached, this was the same response that came out of the hearts and out of the mouths of the people of God. And yet it's not just that they were emotionally in turmoil. There really does seem to be more going on here that reflects a new emphasis in this book as far as how these people are processing their circumstances and where they are turning in a time of fear and a time of anguish. And I'm thinking especially of the emphasis in both Mordecai and the people. All of this, not just about sackcloth and ashes, that is strong enough. Of course, this was a symbol of mourning in that culture. The roughness of the material conveying something of the roughness, the rawness of their emotions. Ashes perhaps associated with the reality of death and how our bodies return to ashes. And it's like these people, by throwing ashes upon themselves, are associating themselves with a death-like experience. And in this case, literally anticipating their own death. But it's not just that, but you find as well something that comes up more than once later, and that's the emphasis on fasting. What is the point of fasting? You don't fast because you're not hungry. In this case, these people weren't fasting because they wanted to lose weight. This was another part of their expression of grief. And in Old Testament terms, people fast as a way of humbling themselves before God. And they fast as a way of drawing near to God and as a way of clearing their lives in order to intercede with God. This is an element of prayer that demonstrates the sincerity of their hearts and the depth of their grief before the Lord. And through that self-denial and the even physical pain that went along with it, expressing to God how pained they were because of the circumstance that they were facing. And as you read about that, even though there aren't words that are given to their prayers, it doesn't take a lot of imagination to figure out the sorts of things that they were praying, because the Old Testament gave them all kinds of examples that they could use to approach the Lord in these kinds of circumstances. We have a word for them. We call them the lament psalms. That's the mood of their emotion here and their fasting. If you wonder what they were praying, let me give you an example of the kinds of things that the scriptures recorded in other people's experience that were in the Bible as a model for how to approach the Lord and express your complaint to him. So Psalm 79 is one of many examples. And it's not too distant from the very circumstances that we're looking at in the book of Esther. Listen to what Asaph says in these words on behalf of the entire nation. O God, the nations have come into your inheritance. They have defiled your holy temple. They have laid Jerusalem in ruins. They have given the bodies of your servants to the birds of the heavens for food, the flesh of your faithful to the beasts of the earth. And that was the very kind of thing that the Babylonians had done years earlier in destroying Jerusalem and wiping out the temple and slaughtering so many of the ancestors of these people. That's the context that they're living in, what we read about in Psalm 79. And so Asaph cries out, how long, O Lord, will you be angry forever? Will your jealousy burn like fire? Pour out your anger on the nations that do not know you and on the kingdoms that do not call upon your name, for they have devoured Jacob and laid waste his habitation. And then right away they recognize that this kind of thing has come upon them as a consequence of their own sins, and so they're not going to leave that out. The very next line says, do not remember against us our former iniquities. Let your compassion come speedily to meet us, for we are brought very low. Father, this is our fault, but take pity on us and wipe away our sins and deal with our enemies. Help us, O God of our salvation, for the glory of your name. Deliver us and atone for our sins for your name's sake. And he goes on and on, expressing his lament to the Lord. That, I believe, was the spirit of these people as they were so crushed by the prospect of the enemy coming in once again and wiping out thousands upon thousands of descendants of Abraham. And yet, it seems we can infer something even more specific as we consider the wording of the passage in verse 3. Look again at verse 3. And at the end it talks about these people with their mourning, but they're doing so with fasting and weeping and lamenting, and many of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. I want you to remember that line, and particularly those three words as they're showing up there in that order, fasting and weeping and lamenting. And I want you to turn with me to Joel The book of Joel, the prophecy of Joel in chapter 2, this is something that I had not realized before. I appreciate a commentator who pointed out the connection in the terminology between Esther chapter 4 and Joel chapter 2. Listen to what Joel urges the people of God to do when they're facing similar circumstances, and it starts in verse 12. He says, "Yet even now declares the Lord, return to me with all your heart, with fasting, with weeping, and with mourning," which is the same word translated lamenting in Esther. And the phraseology is just a little bit different, but it is the same three terms that Joel is urging these people to carry out: fasting, weeping, mourning. And tied to the idea of sackcloth and ashes, that is acceptable and that may be a part of this process. But Joel says, take it deeper than that. It cannot be just external display of emotion. He says, tear up, rend your hearts and not your garments. Return to Yahweh your God, for he is gracious and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love, and he relents over disaster. And it may well be, it seems to be, that the author of Esther phrased the situation in those terms with fasting and weeping and lamenting or mourning in order to echo Joel chapter 2. And as a way of indicating that the situation had gotten these people's attention. Maybe they were thinking specifically of Joel 2 themselves. But they were doing this, it seems, at some level as an earnest seeking of God and perhaps even actual, genuine repentance. And that's where the adversity took them. Not simply to express their grief and their fear, but those kinds of circumstances being used of the Lord to bring them to their knees and to work in them a spirit of repentance. And so adversity creates distress to that level. You may want to keep a finger there in Joel chapter 2, because there seem to be other echoes as we go through this passage. But going back to Esther, as you come to scene 2, you read the beginning of the exchange between Mordecai and Esther. And so let me read for us verses 4 to 9. When Esther's young women and her eunuchs came and told her, the queen was deeply distressed. And so she enters into the turmoil of Mordecai. And in fact, that's very strong terminology as well. It's a term that in other forms is used to speak of a woman writhing in labor. That kind of anguish, even the physical twisting and turning associated with that, is here a way of speaking about just how emotionally disturbed she was. And what is she going to do about it? She's going to deal with it, but it's going to be a kind of a superficial response. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he might take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther called for Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs who had been appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what this was and why it was. Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate. And Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the exact sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. And I pointed out last time that was an enormous sum. It was 10,000 talents. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her and command her to go to the king to beg his favor and plead with him on behalf of her people. And Hathach went and told Esther what Mordecai had said. As we look at the way that this unfolds, and particularly what Mordecai urges this woman to do, it says there to plead with the king, to beg his favor on behalf of his people. His perspective is that the distress they find themselves in requires immediate, strong action, fervent action, channeling the emotion of the distress into the pleas to be made to the king. That's what he's getting at here, is that distress requires action. What's interesting and maybe unexpected is that Esther had no idea what was going on. She assumed that it was something serious, but her attitude was one of just immediately relieving the emotion that Mordecai was struggling with and send him some clothes to cover him up, as if to say, it's okay, it's going to be better. Just settle down. Everything's all right. And she's saying that because she has no idea what is behind his suffering. Her ignorance of their plight shows how insulated she had become from her people. And even though she apparently still had conversation with Mordecai or some kind of interaction with him being right there as a part of the court, it wasn't like she was following circumstances very well. This was a publicly announced thing with all these decrees going out throughout the kingdom. And it shows what an isolated and what we would call a cushy life this woman lived, just totally insulated from the problems of the kingdom and totally isolated from the suffering of her people. You remember that this would have been about 5 years after she married King Xerxes. And over that time, it's like she backed away more and more from her origin and just kind of blended into the comfort of being a part of the king's court and left concern and interest apparently behind. This is how far we would say she had gotten from the concerns of God's people. And that's going to change here very quickly. Remember that leading up to this, a couple of times, the text emphasized Mordecai commanded her, don't talk about who you are. Don't tell people that you're from the nation of Israel. And all of a sudden, because of how desperate this was, immediately he reverses his position and his command. And he says, now is the time to speak up. You've got to leave behind whatever concerns you might have had for your own safety, whatever embarrassment may go along with you confessing that you're one of these people that is on death row. You've got to leave behind perhaps even the concern that your husband will be angry with you when he finds out who you are, because you have effectively been hiding this from him, almost deceiving him about your ethnicity. Says Esther, now is the time to stand up and to confess that you belong to the Jewish people and to use your influence to try to deliver them. What's going to happen as a first-time reader of the story, you're not sure. But what you do pick up is that there is a tension introduced here that hasn't been there in the story before. Because as you first read about Esther, and particularly her relationship to Mordecai, she is in a very passive role, basically just doing whatever he says. And it does use the word for he commanded her to stay quiet before this. He's the authority figure. He's the one in charge. And in this text, he is now issuing another command. He's not soft about it. He is not trying to sort of massage it. It says there in verse 8, command her to go to the king and do this. But what happened is that before that, She had already started to give orders herself. And she was the one who sent out the eunuch to give better clothing to Mordecai. And in fact, the word command is actually in verse 5 when it says that she ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what this was and why it was. Here, this woman is not entirely passive. She is in a unique position of power, and she has gotten comfortable with using that authority. And so here she is giving commands now, and he is pushing back with more commands. There's a tension there. Is she going to go along with the expectations and the demands of her former authority figure? And as you go into chapter 4, verse 10, that tension is not going to be immediately resolved. But let's go on to that scene, the next part of the conversation in verses 10 to 12. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and commanded him to go to Mordecai and say, "All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter so that he may live. But as for me, I have not been called to come into the king these 30 days." What becomes apparent as she describes her dilemma is that this action that Mordecai wants her to take, noble as it is and reasonable as it is from a Jewish perspective, it entails a great deal of risk. And often, when the Lord puts us in these defining moments, what makes it so hard is that there is that kind of risk. There might be relational damage that comes out as a result. There might be financial consequences that will hurt us for standing for the Lord in a particular situation. Any kind of risk. These are not easy decisions. And Esther, with her new authority, is pushing back and expressing her reason for being hesitant and why this is not a good idea for her. In fact, there in the first verse, again, it tells us that she is speaking in terms of command, and she is using her authority to push back, further heightening the tension between these two. And then when she explains herself, you begin to realize where she's coming from in verse 11. Her lack of access to Xerxes shows that her situation actually is precarious. She is not making this up. She was sticking her neck out on the line, literally, and her fear is a reasonable one. Just as when you read Xerxes or Mordecai's initial command, you would say, well, that makes total sense, Esther. Use your influence on behalf of your people. Then she comes back and you say, well, that makes total sense as well, why you would be slow to do that. We, of course, have little experience with this kind of autocratic authority where it could be off with your head, even as a part of the king's court, simply for showing up when you're not called for. I mean, we understand somebody trying to break into the White House, but if you're talking about members of the administration and the president's own wife not being able to approach him unless they're called, and this is a real thing. You read the records that we have of the Persian court, and there were only 7 people who had immediate access to the king. Haman was evidently one of them who could come unannounced and unasked for. But Esther was not in that inner circle. You know, we read the story of chapter 2 and how she ended up in this in this relationship with Xerxes. And maybe it's just our Western romantic bent, but we see it as kind of a Hallmark story or something. This sort of rags to riches, and wow, isn't this cool that this no-name Jew ends up as the queen, and what a wonderful life she must have had. At this moment, she hadn't been with her husband for a month and does not have the confidence or the status to even go in and talk to him about anything, let alone something like this. And furthermore, add to that what we saw in the passage last week at the end of chapter 2 about this whole other group of virgins that were gathered. And how at that point it seems that Xerxes is multiplying concubines and growing his harem yet again with a bunch more women. This is the kind of loose and unfaithful life that this man had. And Esther is just waiting there for his call. She lives at his beck and call, has no opportunity, no clout to be able to approach him. And so you understand the very precarious situation that she's in. This would not just be a risk, like I'm going to lose a little money maybe. This would actually be on the whim of the king. He could kill me simply for approaching him. And that's the risk that she was contemplating. Distress calls for action, yes, but that action is an incredibly risky one in these circumstances. And so now Mordecai has to respond. They both made good and reasonable points. How is he going to come back, and how is he going to argue with her about going forward with this plan? And what he emphasizes primarily, among other things, is the theme of this book as a whole. We have a word for it, providence. It is very theological in nature. He doesn't exactly put it in those terms. The author of Esther doesn't elaborate on it explicitly, but that, as I pointed out, is part of the whole strategy of this book. To sort of cloud what's really going on as far as the plan of God, to make the point that God's ways are often mysterious, behind the scenes, not clearly understood until after the fact, and even in the words he chooses to tell us from Mordecai and Esther, it's in this sideways fashion that he is pointing to the providence of God. But nevertheless, that truth is there, particularly as you package it together with the entire story. And what he's getting at is that risk, as in going ahead and taking that risk, and the confidence you need in order to do that, risk flows from your persuasion that God really is the ruler. And he really is at work in this bleakest of circumstances. And he really is able to use your struggling efforts to advance his plan here. You take those risks. The willingness to do that flows from divine providence and your confidence in it. And let's see specifically what he says in verses 13 and 14. In verse 12, they tell Mordecai what Esther had said, and then here's his reply, verse 13. Do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And then this, who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. As Mordecai argues with Esther, he alternates between a negative point and a positive point. He goes through that two times. First of all, he says in verse 13, don't think that somehow you're going to escape, even though you feel very safe and padded in that area, in the king's palace. You're still a Jew. Nothing's going to change that. There are no exceptions to the decree. You have no reason to think that you won't be slaughtered as well. In fact, as I have pointed out in earlier messages, this was just a totally brutal administration. They killed people on a whim. They did whatever they want. He could have gotten rid of her just like he got rid of Vashti. He has no reason to feel secure. And so Esther, recognize that you're in a bind here. That whatever you do or don't do, your life is on the line, actually. And there are deadly consequences for inactivity. Take care. You're not really protecting yourself. Isn't that often how it is with us as well when we are facing these opportunities to risk something on behalf of the Lord or His plan or His gospel or His people? And we're tempted to think in terms of what's going to be safest for me. We have no idea what is safest for me. And as often has been said, the safest place is in the will of God, not running away from Him. There are even greater risks trying to resist the Lord than to go along with Him and do risky things. And that's the first point that Mordecai makes. And then he says this, that if you keep silent, verse 14, if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. We don't know a lot about Mordecai, but particularly at this point in the story, he really is demonstrating a depth of faith in the providence of God and in God's covenant commitment to His people. He didn't say God might deliver. This is a word of assurance that He will bring relief and deliverance from somewhere. In later rabbinic writings, there were times when that expression, place, was actually used as a way of talking about God as a place of safety. And if he was thinking in those terms, it didn't really get put in writing till much later with the rabbis. It is possible that he's actually talking about God himself when he says from another place. In other words, God is our place of safety, and he's going to guarantee that somehow, some way, through somebody, the deliverance is going to come. Even if he's not being that theological, there is still a confidence that there are other ways that God could work. And that even though she is in such a choice position to make a difference, nobody is indispensable, and God is going to get his work done in some way or another. Other people will take up this challenge. And it can happen in totally unexpected ways. I mean, it seems very likely that she would be the one in that position to carry out the work, but God is very creative, and God can work through totally unlikely circumstances. And so he assures her that the Lord is committed to his people, that he's made certain promises, that he has demonstrated his reliability time and time again before, and he will take care of this. In other words, yes, I think you can make a difference, but you're not some kind of hotshot here. Trying to hold yourself above the fray and do the safe thing. God can do anything and use anybody he wants to get his work accomplished. And yet, in case you hadn't gotten the point, he comes back to the negative side the second time, and he talks about the deadly consequence of inactivity, but in a different way. When he makes the comment, relief is going to come from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And commentators scratch their heads over what in the world he's talking about. Because how could you imagine that the Jewish people would be delivered by the Lord, but that somehow the queen gets caught up in the middle and loses her life, she and her family? Well, we don't really know, but we can imagine some options of how this could happen. I've talked about the intrigue in the court and even in the harem. And there were plenty of ways that somebody like a Haman from the inside could have taken her off the scene, underhandedly, somehow, figuring a way out to assassinate her and cover his tracks, and taking her out of the way, even though his big plan wouldn't end up accomplished. Or, if that's not the case, maybe Mordecai is actually saying, you know, you are in such a unique position in the providence of God. If you don't do what you're supposed to do here, God's going to take care of you. And God himself is going to step in and judge you in some mysterious and overwhelming way because of your unwillingness to take a risk. But thankfully, he ends on a positive point that ends up being the most famous thing recorded in the Bible from the mouth of Mordecai. And he says, who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? And again, that's a sideways statement of the providence of God. And it's kind of like when Jesus is talking with the Pharisees and so forth. He often doesn't just come out and make his point. He asks them a question to get them to ponder. In this case, the unique opportunity that she has in that position. Have you ever thought about this, Esther? How do you think you got there? Who brought you there? And why was it that right now, and 5 years ago leading up to this, here you are in this position when this is all happening? Do you think there's something more going on here than just, you know, this king wanted another toy? Do you think God is behind this? And he urges her with the unique opportunity that is afforded to her by the divinely ordained timing and placement of her life. And going back to Joel chapter 2, remember I said to hold your hand there. Look at what it says in verse 14. After Joel urges these people to repent, to humble themselves, he says, who knows whether he will not turn and relent and leave a blessing behind him, a grain offering and a drink offering for the Lord your God. Also applying the teaching with a question. You know what? Maybe if you all turn from your sin, the Lord will have mercy, not just forgive you, but actually restore you and shower you with blessing and mighty deliverance. Who knows whether that's what's going on here? Kind of sounds like Mordecai. Who knows whether the Lord has put you here for this time and this circumstance? And then we come to the final piece of the conversation in verses 15 to 17, where, thankfully, Esther chooses to put her life on the line. And I would see, as we're connecting all of this together, that providence and Mordecai's emphasis on providence is what prompts her faith, is what finally pushes her over the edge to take the incredible risk that was before her. And why do I say faith? Well, let's go ahead and read these few verses here. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf and do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. Here she jumps onto this emphasis on fasting. And again, people in these circumstances don't fast because they want to lose weight. They fast because they recognize the desperateness of their condition, and they're expressing to the Lord how broken and needy they are, and God, would you have mercy and work? Which, one more time from Joel chapter 2, the very next line after the who knows whether he will turn and relent, says verse 15, blow the trumpet in Zion, consecrate a fast, call a solemn assembly, gather the people, consecrate the congregation, assemble the elders, gather the children, even nursing infants, let the bridegroom leave his room and the bride her chamber. Verse 17, let the priest weep and say, here's the prayer, spare your people, O Lord, make not your heritage a reproach, a byword among the nations. Why should they say among the peoples, where is their God? It's incredible parallel to what was going on in the book of Esther. Even down to, we're going to proclaim a fast here, and everybody at all levels of society, humble yourselves, seek the Lord and say, Lord, your people are destitute, and if our enemies win, it's going to look bad on you. Step up for your own name and your own reputation and your own covenant, Lord. And whether or not Esther herself was thinking in those terms, it's a pretty striking display of the providence of God that these two passages are so close in their pattern of how to deal with this kind of distress. And it seems to be that Esther, at some level, was seeking God and recognizing her need of the Lord and calling on everybody that she possibly had influence over to seek the Lord with her. You might wonder, well, when she goes on to say, if I perish, I perish, how does that fit in with faith? It sounds kind of fatalistic. It sounds kind of like, who knows if God really cares, or who knows what's going to happen, or whether this is going to be any good. If I perish, I perish. You know, what's the use? Let's just go for it. Well, there actually is something to that, based on what Mordecai had already said. He says, if you don't do anything, you're going to die. If you try, you might die. I mean, why not? And folks, sometimes that's a good way to think. As a part of the answer, why are you thinking that not doing anything is going to be better? It's kind of like those lepers who were gathered at the city under the siege, right outside the city. And they said, look, we're going to sit here and starve to death. The enemy has food. Why don't we go over there and at least they might take mercy on us and give us food so we survive? I mean, what's the use? I mean, who cares? We're in a bad position anyway. What do we have to lose? All right, that's not entirely unbiblical. There's a certain right logic about that. Saying that the safe thing is necessarily going to be the safe thing. No. You got problems on either side. And you got to count the cost, but think about it from what's at stake here and how God may choose to use you instead of just you getting wiped out and accomplish nothing. Okay? And it seems we could also infer that by putting it in those terms, she was not presuming on the Lord. She was seeking the Lord, but she was not assuming that he was going to bless her efforts. I mean, after all, this woman wasn't like she was really close to God leading up to this. And she was not assured of the favor of God on her life. She thought it was worth taking a risk. And she had a general trust in God, but she didn't know what God might choose to do. And yet, often, that is also the position that we find ourselves in, even people that are close to God. So I thought about the book of Daniel again. And what is sometimes a confusing comment that those three friends make when they say to Nebuchadnezzar, we're not going to bow down before your idol. If you want to throw us in the furnace of fire, go for it. Our God is able to deliver us. And then they say, but if not, we're not going to bow down anyway. So they know he's able, and they're kind of thinking he will deliver them. And they want to make a statement about their faith, but they're not assuming he's going to. And they say, you know, we're going to leave a little margin here if we don't understand what God's doing, and maybe something else is going on. Even if not, we're going to do the right thing. And that seems to be the way that this woman is thinking as well. And her decision at that moment marks a change, a transformation from passivity or accommodation, where she was just going along with the flow of the Persian customs and of what made most sense for survival and just fitting in and trying to work with the situation for your personal advantage, or just kind of looking out for yourself and going with the flow of the world. That's how we could characterize her before all of this, but this moment marks a change to a courageous activity on behalf of God and God's covenant people. And we know the rest of the story. We don't want to get there too quickly. We want to ponder here the difficult position this woman was in, and the very real struggle that this involved for her, and the courage it took to basically throw all of her earthly comforts and security away, put her life on the line in order to save her people. This is really remarkable. And that leads me to this statement of the theme: responding to providence, believers must be willing to take risks in order to relieve human suffering and pursue God's purposes. Responding to providence, we must be willing to take risks in order to relieve human suffering and pursue God's purposes. I think that fairly brings together the human and the divine side. That, yes, she made a wonderful choice here, but it's not so much about what a heroine she is. It's about how God mightily uses these weak people who are willing to take a step of faith into the unknown. And they're doing that for two purposes: to relieve the suffering that was ahead for God's people, and in that they are aligning themselves with God's covenant and God's kingdom and God's glory, and showing that they value the Lord and his purposes more than they value their earthly comfort. They're willing to take risks because of that. Now, as I say, probably most of us will not be in such epic scenarios as this woman, where one choice, we're going to just like save the world. Okay. But the same holds even in the most mundane sorts of situations that we regularly find ourselves in. And I want to leave us with a few questions, just thinking in terms of categories of people and different scenarios you might find yourself in, where all of this actually does apply. It's not just an ancient story about a very unique situation. The truth here applies. So how about this, even for our children and our teenagers? Talk about taking risks, trusting in the providence of God. For example, what will you do when another young person is being mocked or bullied? What will you say when someone makes an off-color joke or a racist comment? How will you respond when a friend pressures you to do something that you know is wrong? What will you do when a sibling is about to make a choice that is dishonoring to your parents? Or going forward, as we grow up, these kinds of struggles get all the harder. And as adults, we might face things like this. What will you do when a coworker suggests an unethical or a dishonest way of handling some issue in the office? As a parent, will you actually deal with your children's rebellion, or will you just let it go because it's a lot easier that way? For all of us, will you stick your neck out and finally give the gospel to a family member, to a friend, to a coworker, to a neighbor, or even a stranger? You really do feel like your whole life sometimes, or at least your social standing in the world in these relationships, is on the line. You feel like you're going to perish in a sense by actually speaking a word for Christ. Will you lovingly confront a fellow believer who is going down a sinful path, or just say, I'm going to pray that somebody else will come along to talk to them? And will you sacrifice of yourself and take on that challenging ministry the Lord has placed before you, even though you have no guarantee of how it's going to turn out in the end? In all of those kinds of scenarios, are you going to do the thing that seems safe at the moment, or take a risk for the glory of God? Our sense of safety is all messed up. The seemingly safe path turns out to be the most dangerous. Remember Proverbs 29:25, the fear of man lays a snare, but whoever trusts in the Lord is the safe one. The story of Esther motivates us to take action, because God is superintending our circumstances and he uses our efforts to move forward his great plan of redemption. And in fact, his great plan of redemption also operated in terms of somebody taking not just a risk like I might die, but somebody knowing he would die. And his name is Jesus. And as he faced the prospect of the cross, he said, Father, if you are willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. That's the spirit of Esther. It's the willingness to pay the price by the grace of God, because you are confident that God's will is best and that his purposes triumph even through your actions.